Thank you. Good evening, everyone. I'm Dominic Packer. I'm the Associate Dean for Research in the College of Arts and Sciences here at Lehigh, and I welcome you for what promises to be a really exciting and thought-provoking evening. I'm thrilled to see you all here, almost packed house, and grateful for the opportunity to spend an evening with you. I'd like to start by thanking Jeffrey Kenner, who makes these events possible, as well as, and in a moment I'll talk a bit more about her, our esteemed guest for this evening, Judy Woodruff. Unfortunately, Jeff Kenner could not be with us tonight, but I'd like to take a brief moment to tell you a little bit about how important these Kenner lectures on cultural understanding are for Lehigh. The 2019 lecture, what we're doing tonight, marks the 22nd year since Jeff endowed this lecture fund, and it's become the premier lecture in the College of Arts and Sciences and the university community. Every year, this lecture features world-class leaders interacting with Lehigh students, faculty, and capacity audiences. Mr. Kenner graduated from Lehigh in 1965 as an industrial engineering major. He earned a second degree the next year in business and then began a long and successful career. In 1986, he formed his own firm, Kenner & Company Incorporated, which specializes in leveraged buyouts and recapitalization of closely held companies. I don't know what that means, but Jeff's support of Lehigh has nevertheless been unwavering. Here are just a few things. He served on the Board of Trustees from 1995 to 2002. He's committed a great deal to scholarship support of undergraduates. He's provided funding for a variety of spaces around campus. His name currently is affiliated with the renovated Great Room in Lamberton Hall. He's provided critical seed funding for the Integrated Business and Engineering undergraduate program and been a longtime member of Lehigh's Asa Packer, Tower, and Leadership Plaza societies. The Kenner Lecture brings to our campus speakers who help us to confront our preconceptions and challenge us to see things from new perspectives. Past speakers have included Nobel Prize winners, political leaders, and prominent members of the media. And tonight, we are absolutely thrilled to welcome Judy Woodruff as our speaker for 2019. An eminent broadcast journalist, Ms. Woodruff is the anchor and managing editor of the PBS NewsHour. She has covered politics and other news for more than three decades at CNN, NBC, and PBS. Her career has been pathbreaking in all sorts of ways, and as but one example, when she and the late Gwen Ifill were announced as co-anchors of the PBS NewsHour in 2013, it marked the first time in history that an American network broadcast was co-anchored by two women. When I learned at about 3 p.m. this afternoon that I was going to be introducing Judy, I pulled up her Twitter feed, hoping to spice these remarks up a little bit. Unfortunately for my remarks, they were perfectly on point, nothing scandalous or salacious. But one of her recent tweets did catch my eye. And it began, "A lot of news today." And I thought, yeah, that just about sums it up. Every day these days, it seems like there's a lot of news today, right? We used to have things called slow news days, and I don't really remember what those were like, but it must have been great. Judy Woodruff served as the White House correspondent for NBC News from 1977 to 1982. She then became the chief Washington correspondent for the McNeil-Lehrer NewsHour at PBS from 1983 to 1993. During this time, she also anchored PBS's award-winning weekly documentary series, Frontline, with Judy Woodruff. And then from 1993 to 2005, she served as the anchor and senior correspondent at CNN, where her duties included anchoring the weekday program Inside Politics. And in 2006, she returned to PBS, where, as said, she is currently anchor and managing editor of the PBS NewsHour. Ms. Woodruff has been a visiting professor at Duke University's Institute of Public Policy, served as a visiting fellow at Harvard. She's a founding co-chair of the International Women's Media Foundation, an organization dedicated to promoting and encouraging women in communication industries worldwide. The Kenner Lecture on Cultural Understanding is fundamental to the culture of the College of Arts and Sciences and to Lehigh University. These lectures educate and enlighten us. They challenge and they provoke us. They cause us to ask new questions, and every once in a while, they might cause us to chart a new course in the world. And particularly now, when every day there's a lot of news today, and when the credibility of the media is increasingly under threat, when fake news proliferates, and as social media platforms fundamentally change the business model for journalism, who better to speak with us tonight than the journalist, broadcaster, and consummate professional, Judy Woodruff. And one final note for the evening. At the conclusion of her lecture, there'll be a question and answer session with microphones. And we strongly encourage the audience to pose thoughtful questions. I will just say, if you find that you have more of a comment than a question, I would ask that you either find the question lurking within the comment or maybe secede the microphone to somebody else. But other than that, I wish you a very enjoyable evening. And my friends, again, please welcome, and I give you Judy Woodruff.
WLBR, Bethlehem.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you, Dean Packer. You filled in admirably at the last minute. We appreciate that. Did you hear that music? That's familiar. I am delighted to be here. As you know, as you just heard, not much going on in the news these days, so it was easy to get away. I am truly honored, though, to be here in this beautiful Lehigh Valley. What a gem of a part of the country this is. You have a secret here. You need to get the word out. So more people move. No, it is truly a beautiful part of this country, and you are so blessed to live and to be, to study here, to work here, to live here. And I am incredibly honored to have been asked to deliver this year's Kenner Lecture. I did read a little about Jeff Kenner. You just heard about him. I know he's a Lehigh graduate. I know he's actually a double graduate. He got both an engineering and a business degree. He's been immensely supportive of the school. To read about the people who have given this lecture over the years, from Madeleine Albright, the former Secretary of State, the former President of Ireland, Mary Robinson, former Senator Bill Bradley, I'm doubly honored to be here with you. And I just have to say another word about this remarkable school. Lehigh has such a distinguished history, as I've learned, as I've been preparing for tonight and reading about this place. It, as you know, grew out of that tumultuous time after the Civil War, when, as your own website notes, the United States was both rebuilding from the terrible and costly conflict of North versus South, but also flexing its muscles as a new economic power. It was the owner of the Lehigh Valley Railroad, an essential link, as iron and coal were increasingly being used in industry, had to be transported long distances, who stepped up. Your founder, Asa Packer, had a vision. He made an enormously generous gift to create a new university, as he put it, to serve the intellectual and moral improvement of the young men of the Lehigh Valley. We're going to forgive him for that, because a lot of amazing women have walked through these doors over the years. But also over the years, this school has grown to be one of the most respected institutions in this country of higher learning, renowned for its research, for its high academic standards. And as my husband pointed out when I was talking to him this past weekend about visiting Lehigh, he said, you know, they have a 96% retention rate. Students who come here stay here. They like it, they learn, and they are committed to this place. What higher recommendation could there be? So congratulations to this amazing school for what you are doing to prepare the next generation of American leaders. Let's give Lehigh a hand. It is a treat to be with you, and I can say that having spent the day, part of the afternoon, with Lehigh students in the School of Arts and Sciences, I can testify that's absolutely true. They grilled me with tougher questions than President Trump gets at his news conferences. True. I want to talk this evening about the current political divide and explore with you how it got this way and ask whether it should continue as it is. When I started out as a political reporter in the early 1970s, the country was fresh on the heels of the civil rights movement. Federal legislation had been passed in 1964 to end segregation in public places and to ban employment discrimination on the basis of race, color, religion, sex, or national origin. A year later, in 1965, the Voting Rights Act passed and aimed to overcome legal barriers at the state and local level that prevented African Americans from exercising their right to vote. Martin Luther King had been assassinated 3 years later, in 1968, the year I graduated from college, for his peaceful but revolutionary resistance, as had Robert F. Kennedy, the brother of the president, who had himself been assassinated in 1963. It was a traumatic time for all of us living at that time, for anyone growing up in America. As we think back on it, it's hard to imagine what we went through during that period of the 1960s. But all this, combined with the war in Vietnam, which the U.S., of course, did not win, but which cost over 50,000 American lives, left this country feeling divided and in many ways unsure of itself. From President Lyndon Johnson, who oversaw passage of these huge pieces of civil rights legislation that changed lives, as well as Medicare, to Richard Nixon, who, for all of his problems with Watergate, opened the door to environmental protection and more equal treatment of women through the Equal Employment Opportunity Act. It was a time of enormous churn and change in this country, the 1970s. Women and people of color were finally being given something closer to equality, although, of course, it would take many years. It is still taking years for real and complete progress to be made. But today, the struggle, and today, the struggle continues. The Nixon presidency ended in disgrace, as we know. It would fall to Gerald Ford and then Jimmy Carter, the first president I covered, to realize more of the dreams of unity and to discover new fault lines among the American people, with, for example, immigrants coming in from Vietnam and from Cuba, the Mariel Boatlift of 1980. The percentage of the population that is immigrant rose from a low of about 5% in 1970 to almost 15% today. That has created strains in this country that have grown pronounced, even with this bustling, booming economy that is producing jobs for so many able-bodied Americans. I'm condensing all this into a few sentences to make the point that the United States has and had endured terrible divisions, certainly during the Vietnam War, certainly during the Civil Rights Movement, even during the Women's Movement, but would enjoy a period, we would go on to enjoy a period of relative calm and comparative equality as we began a period of economic growth under President Reagan and presidents to follow him, even more so under President Bill Clinton's time in the White House, the roaring 1990s, some people refer to it as. That along, we saw that period came the fall of the Soviet Union, the end of the Cold War. All that seemed to give us strength as a country and to give us some sense of achievement after the lingering effects of the war in Vietnam. But rising inequality as we entered this new millennium along economic lines, along gender lines, along racial lines, divided the country anew and has left us, many of us, with grievances that are taking a very long time for us to work through. People often ask me if I have ever seen anything like what we are witnessing in Washington right now. And I do think back to that period in the 1960s when I was a young woman. I was finishing high school and then college. And I think about the 70s. But my answer is no. I've never seen anything like what we are living through today. Yes, I've covered serious political disagreements between Republicans and Democrats. Jimmy Carter, who had shellacked Gerald Ford just 4 years earlier, was devastated when he lost to Ronald Reagan. George H.W. Bush, President Bush 41, and his supporters were equally devastated to lose to Bill Clinton, whom many of them considered unworthy. Governor of a small state of Arkansas, what is he doing coming in and taking over the White House from President Bush? as devastated as Al Gore was to George W. Bush in 2000 because of that act of the United States Supreme Court after the hanging chads in the state of Florida, we remember what happened, and so on. Barack Obama was seen as an illegitimate president by some on the right when he was elected, most vividly, as we look on it back on it now, by President Trump, who heavily promoted the birther movement, calling into question whether President Obama was born in the United States and should have even been allowed to take office. So, yes, we have seen division in this country. We have seen our political parties fight tooth and nail to win elections. But when the vote counting was over, when the anger calmed, they honored the results. After his loss, Jimmy Carter and his wife, Rosalynn, went on to create the Carter Center in Atlanta, dedicated to peaceful conflict resolution and aiding some of the poorest nations on the planet. Since it was founded, it has helped to improve life for people in more than 80 countries by resolving conflicts, by advancing democracy and human rights, preventing disease, and improving mental health care, a passion of Rosalynn Carter. Al Gore gave a magnanimous concession speech shortly after the Supreme Court ruled against him in 2000. He stood before a bank of cameras and he said, "Almost a century and a half ago, Senator Stephen Douglas told Abraham Lincoln, who had just defeated him for the presidency, 'Partisan feeling must yield to patriotism. I'm with you, Mr. President, and God bless you.'" And Al Gore continued, "Well, in that same spirit, I say to President-elect Bush that what remains of partisan rancor must now be put aside, and may God bless his stewardship of this country." He went on, "While we yet hold and do not yield our opposing beliefs, there is a higher duty than the one we owe to our political party. This is America, and we put country before party. We will stand together behind our new president." John McCain said this about Barack Obama on the night he conceded in November 2008, and I'm quoting, "In a contest as long and difficult as this campaign has been, his success alone commands my respect for his ability and his perseverance, but that he managed to do so by inspiring the hopes of so many millions of Americans who had once wrongly believed that they had little at stake or little influence in the election of an American president is something I deeply admire and commend him for achieving." That was John McCain. Like most or perhaps all of you, I hope that these sentiments are ones that will prevail when our next election takes place, no matter which side wins. But I worry because I have never seen the level of division that we see today, not just among our elected leaders, but among the American people. The language people use to disagree, not just calling those in the other party the adversary, but instead they're calling them the enemy, and too often unpatriotic or un-American. For example, when President Trump criticizes those who disagree with him, he at times questions their loyalty to the United States. Whether on questions of immigration and the border or foreign policy, on social issues like abortion, he has accused those who favor abortion rights, as he said in this year's State of the Union address, of being guilty of executing babies. He's accused undocumented immigrants to the U.S. from Mexico and Central America of being made up mostly of gang members, rapists, and murderers. And with his travel bans, he has tried to sharply limit the number of immigrants from Muslim countries. He has said the migrant surge from the Middle East is like a Trojan horse. And at one point he added, "You look at the migration, it's strong young men. We cannot take a chance that the people coming over here are not going to be ISIS affiliated." But with the increasing number of anti-Semitic incidents we've seen in this country, like the shooting at the Pittsburgh synagogue a few months ago, anti-Muslim incidents that we've seen around this country and then exacerbated by last week's mass shooting in New Zealand at two mosques. There is a clear sense, because we live in a global community. We are all now connected by social media, by the internet, in ways that we have never been connected before. Today, there's a clear sense that some of the most vitriolic and most hateful language is grounded in religious or ethnic differences. Religious or ethnic differences. Just 2 weeks ago, a freshman Democratic member of Congress drew criticism after she spoke of her fellow members who support policies that favor Israel as having divided loyalties, having allegiance to a foreign country. The criticism rained down on her. The Democratic Party leadership faced pressure to censure her. They negotiated a resolution that was originally aimed just at her for being anti-Semitic, but they ultimately worded it in a way that would condemn all forms of hate speech. As if that weren't painful enough, The Washington Post has a story this morning describing a meeting of Democratic members in recent days, members of Congress, in which an effort to better understand each other, this was just a couple of weeks ago, broke up in anger and tears after a Jewish congressman asked that freshman Democrat Ilhan Omar apologize and that the group publicly affirm Israel's right to exist and to protect itself. The article described how another Muslim member of Congress in the meeting, Rashida Tlaib, started to cry as she remembered her grandmother suffering in the West Bank at the time of Israeli control. Imagine these conversations that are taking place right now among our elected members of Congress and the Senate. I share this story, because I think it illustrates how some of our political leaders are trying to work through the raw differences in our points of view in an effort to bring their party together, even all of us together, but finding it is not easy to do. This group met in private, behind the scenes, as congressional leaders were trying to figure out how to address that resolution, the pressure to condemn Representative Omar for her comments. But even before all this broke out in the open, we in the news media have been regularly reporting on and weighing the political divide that has the country in the palm, in the grip of its hand, over immigration, over the border wall, over health care, over government spending, whether a large increase in defense spending is warranted, and so on, for our spending priorities, whether the Environmental Protection Agency budget should be slashed by one-third, and so on. Very tough and difficult questions that get to the center of some of the divisions that we're talking about right now. And this doesn't take into consideration the fight over the Russia probe, the Robert Mueller investigation that wise observers are saying should be wrapping up soon. New bits and pieces emerge from time to time, but his work, I have to say, has been remarkably leak-free. Some of us in the media contribute to this divide that I'm talking to you about by taking sides ourselves. It's well known that the president refers to, and this is at a time when the president refers to most or almost all of us as creating fake news and being the enemy of the American people. I want to stand here and tell you I am not an enemy of the American people. And I don't produce fake news. Yes, I make mistakes. I'm human. My colleagues make mistakes. We're human. But we don't traffic in false information. That's not what we do. That's not what journalists do. It violates our very sense of commitment to journalism, to reporting the news, to even think about that. But that is the climate that we are now living in, and more and more Americans are hearing this charge that is directed at the press and believing it, and calling us and then suspecting us of being you know, having an agenda and of wanting to take over the government and turn it in another direction. Having said all that, I think it is a terrible mistake for reporters, for journalists to engage in some kind of contest with the president. We only serve our readers and our viewers when we report the news straight, when we focus on what matters in people's lives and not when we get into some sort of name-calling contest with the president of the United States. I tell my colleagues at the NewsHour every morning we need to keep our heads down, do our work as thoroughly and as carefully as we can all day long until we put our head on the pillow at night. That is the way we fulfill our mission. That is the way we fulfill our mission, and not by getting into some sort of contest with the president or any other political leader who labels us in ways that are not accurate. But having said that, a lot of airspace and a lot of print pages are being taken up with advocating right now for one political side or another, and vilifying, by the way, the other side. And with growing power that we see every day of the internet, of social media, citizens can and they are joining in the debate. They can email, they can post on Facebook, they can go to YouTube, they can tweet, whatever their favorite platform is. And these comments can be uplifting, they can be informative, they can be educational, but they can also be threatening and worse, and everything and anything in between. With this wonderful, wonderful democratizing technology has come, along with the good, the fact that more people can participate, more people can weigh in, more people can say what they think. And I welcome that, and my colleagues welcome that. But along with it has come the dark side. Facebook and YouTube, their tech staff worked feverishly last Friday in the hours after the terrible New Zealand shooting, the massacre at those two mosques, to take down live video that man had posted. He knew exactly how to post it from the camera that was going live and the cap he was wearing. But they had to work for hours and hours and days to pull down one and a half million videos that people were attempting to recreate, to send, to share, to look at, and so on. Unthinkable. But this is what we deal with now. And I interviewed yesterday a woman who reports on the social media industry, who said if a similar massacre were to take place a week from now, or a few weeks from now, she believes the social media companies would be no better equipped to deal with this kind of, with these images that are out there. So it's, on the one hand, it's uplifting, and on the other hand, it can be a monster in our midst. The larger question, though, raised by all of this is what level of difference and disagreement can we live with as a society? If we have come to view those who disagree with us on questions, whether it's the role of government, how active should government be in our lives, immigration, or education, or healthcare, you name it, race, religion. If we have come to view people who disagree with us on these issues as our, not just people we disagree with, but our enemy, and not just as someone who happens to have a different view, but as someone who's not loyal, not a loyal American, how do we process that? What are we left with? Is that really where we want to be? Can we continue to ratchet up and or stand by as others ratchet up the hateful language, follow the lead of political leaders who thrive on conflict? Or do we look for ways to bridge some of these divides? We have no illusion. I have no illusion. I know you don't, that we're going to come up with some sort of kumbaya moment where we're all holding hands and everything's, we're all going to live happily ever after. And besides, this is a country that was built on vigorous debate. It was built on fierce disagreements about how to go forward, what kind of government to create, how much power to give to the states, how much power to give to the federal government, to give to the center of this government. That has made us strong, and it has made us even stronger over time, because we can have these vigorous debates. We can, and we do speak out about our differences in public. We are not intimidated or fearful that we're going to be thrown in jail or worse if we criticize the president or another political leader because we have a particular view. That's the freedom. That's the democratic system that we cherish, that our founding fathers created. But is there a way to preserve open debate without damaging relationships? More and more Americans are avoiding that question, I believe, by moving, well, not just I believe, I see, you see it in the statistics. People are moving to parts of the country to live near other people who agree with them politically. The demographers are seeing this. People, rather than confronting people who feel differently than they do, who see differently, have different political ideas, in many cases, not in everyone, but in many cases, they're moving to places where they feel more at home in their views. But I hope that that is not the future of this country. I hope that more of us, that most of us, will look for ways to look each other in the eye and to listen to each other and learn from each other and not give up having a diverse society where we have disagreements and we have vigorous debate about whether it's the most divisive subject, if it's abortion, if it's immigration, if it's race, whatever it is, our religion, that we're able to have these conversations, but that we're strengthened by it rather than running away from it. Through forums, frankly, like this one, through and many others that you have in the Lehigh Valley area, many of them sponsored at the university, through community activities that are geared toward hearing each other out, learning why other people feel the way they do and think the way they do. We may not have leaders in our very near future who will lead us out of this period of difference and division. So I think in many ways it comes back to us. It comes back to us to make these tough decisions, to sit and have a cup of coffee with somebody who believes differently than we do, to have those hard conversations. We in the news media can help. We can, gosh knows, we need to stick to the facts. We need to report only what we know to be accurate. But, of course, that's getting harder as different news outlets claim their own version of facts or choose to focus on one set of grievances over another in order to make a larger point. But we still know, if we're covering a story, we can find out what is factual, and we can try to stick to that so that the people who, whether they rely on the NewsHour or they rely on another news organization, they know that that's a place they can trust. It's a place that they can continue to respect as having done our homework, of having tried to get to the bottom of a story, having tried to get to the bottom of whatever the news development of the day is, that at least we are trying to get to facts, to the truth. At the NewsHour, our job every day is to focus on what we think matters most to the American people and to try to tell it, explain it, put it in context. No more than that, no less than that. That's why, frankly, we believe our audience numbers have held up over the last few years, because we are trying every day really hard. We are committed to reporting information factually to the American people and not just focusing on the latest hot-button issue or tweet. I'm going to wrap up by bringing us back to my opening remark about Lehigh's founding in the period after the Civil War. It was a period. It was then, and it is now, potentially can be a period of reconciliation coming out of a period of great division. There was, as you know so well, generosity on the part of one person, Mr. Packer, and he had a vision. And it's exactly that sort of reconciliation and vision that we need right now as a country, in our communities, in our schools, in our places of worship. You, literally, every one of you can help lead the way. You can be part of this conversation. And you can say, well, I live here in central Pennsylvania. I'm not sure what I can do. Every American, I think, today has a responsibility to try to bring us through this very difficult moment that we are living in. We can't wait for some shining moment, some one individual to show up and make a difference. And yes, you know, there will be talented individuals who show up, but it has to come from inside the hearts of the American people. So as you head into another hotly contested presidential election, you're familiar with that here in Pennsylvania, and you're going to have another one next year. It's going to start right now and for the rest of this year. The stakes are huge. I don't have to tell you that. But you, every one of you, can make a difference. We in the media need to do our part. We all need to do our part. And I am betting that we will all, we are going to be engaged. We're going to be engaged in this fight, if you want to call it that, to reach some kind of reconciliation, not perfection, but some kind of reconciliation where we can at least talk to each other, listen to each other, because it matters so much. It matters for our younger generation. It matters for the future of our country. I look to these students, the ones I talked to today, and I think they are so smart and so capable. They are going to be the voices of reason and reconciliation, and they will have the vision that I think will help bring us through this. But it does matter. The stakes are huge, and I'm just glad to have had this opportunity tonight to talk with you a little bit about it. Thank you very much for having me. Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, I understand that we have time for questions, and so don't be bashful. I'm going to move out and around from the lectern and try to recognize. Let's see, who's going to step forward? There's a microphone here, and there's a microphone here. So, or you can shout your question from your seat.
I have a question for you.
All right, I can repeat it if somebody doesn't hear it. Yes, sir.
Into your show, can you give us like a quick behind the scenes, like what goes into putting it together?
Oh, my goodness. This is a great question. What goes into putting the program together? Well, it's a nonstop process. We come together in the morning at 9:45. We have a meeting that usually runs till about 10:15 or 10:30, where we talk about everything that could possibly happen in the day, in the news that day. And we talk about how we structure the show. What are we going to make room for? What are we going to not make room for? We have speaking of vigorous debate around the table. And then, of course, 2 hours later, everything changes. And we have to reorder the show again. Now, it doesn't happen every day, but it happens a lot. We come out of that meeting with a plan. We go out and we say, all right, Judy's going to interview so-and-so. Amna Nawaz is going to be at the southern border doing another story. Yamiche Alcindor will be talking to someone at the White House. Lisa Desjardins will be on the Hill. John Yang, William Brangham, my amazing team. People will be working, and we've got people behind the scenes. We'll be ordering stories from abroad, internationally. But again, we have to be mindful of what's going on. If the news changes later in the day and say, Robert Mueller issues a report, we don't know. I mean, being driven here this morning, I was thinking, okay, I kept checking my smartphone to see if the Mueller report was coming out. I don't know anything, but I have an amazing team. And to answer your question, it is not one person. It is a team of 125 hardworking folks and who work around the clock from the time they open their eyes in the morning until they put their head on the pillow at night. But thank you for the question. Anybody else? Let's see.